it's Vic Porcelli. Come hang out with Ken Williams and me every Monday through Friday from 9 to 11. But right now, it's back to the Randy Tobler Show on 101.9 and 94.1 News Talk STL.
Well, welcome to the third hour of the show. We're going to spend some time that may seem like it's in the weeds to you, but whether you're a small businessman or woman and employing someone, maybe you're a manager at a larger company and you need some now and then work. Maybe you're just taking an Uber somewhere when you're on vacation or you're on a business trip. Perhaps you're driving that Uber. A little extra pocket change to make up for, thank you, Joe, the inflation impact on your dollar. Some new regulations that have come down by the United States Department of Labor are absolutely going to hamstring independent workers, gig workers, 1099 workers. And how many of you either have been, are, or know someone who's in that? Well, to help us unpack what's going on, and they flew it under the radar, is a wonderful, wonderful lady named Jennifer Oliver O'Connell, and she is a beautiful member of the Independent Women's Forum, one of my favorite groups. She's a visiting fellow there at Independent Women's Forum, and it's really great to have you. I talked with you with my Mid-Missouri show, and I wanted the St. Louis audience to hear you, Jennifer. Thanks for coming back.
Well, thank you so much for having me on again, Dr. Randy. It's been quite a privilege. I appreciate it.
And I'm really glad that you have a very compelling personal story starting in California with a template that the federal government then adopted in these rules and how it impacted you and your family. And I think that's a beautiful, well, it's a beautiful story with a bad ending, right? So tell us about it.
Correct. One of the reasons I moved to California when I was 22, so that was about 36 years ago, was to pursue independence in terms of the workspace. 30 years ago, places like, you know, Chicago, which is where I was born and raised, in Missouri, you know, St. Louis, they weren't into you work from home or you work on your own. You go to a job 9 to 5 and that's about it. So along with graduate school was the beauty of being able to create my own work and create my own space. And I've had corporate jobs, full-time jobs, and, you know, they were always a means to an end. They were always a means to build skill so that I could have my own. I was finally at that space after many, many years of fits and starts. I'm a yoga instructor, highly trained, and I was certifying yoga schools under 1099. I was teaching yoga. I was also, you know, running workshops and things like that. And I, along with my writing and reinvention work, I was doing reinvention coaching, helping nonprofits, you know, underprivileged women, things like that, get from one space in their life to another. Mm-hmm. And then AB 5 rolled along. Assembly Bill 5 was created by the California unions. Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher, who was the assemblywoman at that time who sponsored it or spearheaded it, was totally pro-union, and they basically did a number where we don't want anybody doing gig work. They were basically targeting Uber and Lyft. What they did was target probably close to 45 million independent contractors in California, upended their lives. People lost income. People lost jobs. 600 professions were affected. And me personally, my yoga business went, the drain to $2,000 to $4,000 income that we were bringing in to shore up our life was gone immediately because mom and pop, you know, except for a few corporate studios, yogas are mom and pop. They rely on contractors and people who can come in and teach workshops, come in and do pop-ups and classes and things like that. And if you're not able to be a 1099, they're not able to make you an employee. You've run a business before, Randy. You know the major cost that it takes just to bring somebody on board. And you're going to do that for one class or one workshop. That makes absolutely no sense. No. So between AB 5 and COVID, mom and pop yoga studios just went down the tubes. Our income went down the tubes. It was also evil that during COVID, when we could have been working from home, many of us could have been, AB 5 restricted us from doing that. So we were locked down and we were also broke. We were farmed into the unemployment system, which had no idea how to handle independent contractors and actually used it to target and audit people. So you look at what happened in California. The result after 4 years is that their unemployment is at the highest again. AB5 did nothing to increase regular W-2 work. And it also did nothing to, you know, it totally removed 1099 work. In fact, the regular employment dropped along with people who are 1099 after 4 years of AB5. Now they want to take that package and move it into this Department of Labor rule. They're not saying it's the ABC test, which is at the heart of AB5. They're saying it's the six factors that they want to process that allow you to see whether you are an employee or an independent contractor. And so it's the same poison pill, but this time they want to spread it to everybody, not just California. What happens in California never stays in California.
It's just awful. And your story reminds me, metaphorically, I'm thinking of an octopus, that's the federal government, and formerly, and still the California, with so many tentacles strangling people like you who are trying to not only make their own lives, and you have a beautiful family with a child that has special needs that you're taking care of, and beautiful family trying to do that, burn the midnight oil, develop a second income stream so you can be independent, be self-sufficient, live the American dream. And this big octopus is up there being fed by special interest groups, namely the unions, and those who like to centralize government and control our lives, basically squelching out that opportunity to do that. And then, like you say, I never thought of that before, locking you out from the opportunities for unemployment while you try to find another alternate route now that they've closed that door, you know? And it's just so many different tentacles just strangling you. And we could be looking at that for, like, what did you say, 600 different professions or different jobs?
That's correct. 600 professions, and we're still counting. Freelancers Against AB5, Karen Anderson, who created the group, and she is also a IWF fellow. She has, you know, painstakingly documented people's stories and people's professions, and she's still collecting stories from people. Even some chilling fallout from the Department of Labor rule, which went into effect on March 11th. And so there's already chilling effect happening, and she's documenting this. So, yeah, over 600 professions and counting will be affected by this if it is not stopped.
I've relayed to you in a previous conversation. I'll tell my audience now, I jumped off the medical industrial complex. You know, it's all about the bill, not the patient. Make sure you get your codes right. Check all the boxes, kind of a thing. And I'm doing an independent direct-to-patient kind of a practice, and patients love it. I think we're finding great. We're uncovering things that doctors in the turnstile medicine don't have a chance to spend time with people. And I know in your yoga instruction, it's the same thing, right? I mean, you work with people, you learn about them, you inspire them. You know, you can get a lot done in that one-to-one relationship. And I'm thinking, wow, I probably need to get someone to help me do the secretarial work that I'm doing now, but I don't have the means and the patient demand to really hire a full-time worker. So I'm working till midnight doing all of the, you know, jumping through the hoops that are left when you deal with any kind of medical interaction. And I can't do that now. How am I going? What am I going to do? I don't want to comply with all the regulations or deal with the risk of not complying with an employee type relationship. And so I'm sort of caught in the middle. It hits me personally. And I know many, many people out there, as small businesses are expanding in this recover from the recession type of a thing and the pandemic, a lot of people are really going to be flummoxed as to how to move forward, Jennifer. This is really an existential threat to the small businessman and woman.
It certainly is, and it is written. One of our IWF fellows and business owners from New Jersey, Elizabeth Nader, she says that it was written by someone who's never, ever run a business, who never, ever had to make a payroll. And she's correct. Julie Sue and this wage and labor person who's, you know, testimony was just awful, created a lot of chutes and ladders, a lot of traps for the small business owners. They don't know whether they're coming or going. How many small business owners have a phalanx of lawyers that are able to protect them from the pitfalls of such a rule? They don't. It is a total kneel to unions, a kneel to large corporations, and a destruction of smaller corporations and even startups, people who want to start their business, people who want to bootstrap. They aren't able to do that because they're not able to collaborate with people on a 1099 basis or just on a handshake basis. A lot of people are willing to collaborate with certain names and certain bright lights because they know it's going to advance what they do. And so this rule is killing collaboration as well.
Well, you know, I think about it from time to time. I've been asked to do a lecture on menopausal therapy or birth control for women, you know, since I'm a board certified OB-GYN. And I'm thinking, well, my gosh, if I get a little honorarium for that now, I guess that makes me a 1099, but I can't do that. Why are they? You know what I mean? It's like dystopian, Jennifer. And you, here you are trying to help young aspiring medical students. And now, like, I'm afraid I'm going to be some kind of a federal felon if I do that. Or the person who is asking me to do that. You know, I know everyone out there, if they think this through, is impacting them either as the worker end of it or as the employer end of it. And the person who just needs a little help. What about the grandma who's an empty nester and wants to go and help out at the local daycare center where we know there's a paucity of help and capacity for the demand. And she just wants to work a couple hours or half a day, a couple times a week and give the local daycare center help. On either end of this of that equation, it's now a very frightening proposition.
Exactly. And that was one of the things that happened in AB5, is that many seniors who were retiring and wanted to supplement their income and not compromise their pension or their Social Security, people who were wanting to move into retirement and do something else, that not be under an employment model, those opportunities were totally killed, and it will do the same nationally with this rule. You know, the people who go retire, snowbirds, people who like to work part-time here and there, as you said, I personally know someone, a yoga student, who does work at a daycare on a 1099 basis. That will totally ruin that opportunity for her because of this rule.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know what? I'm glad that you are a yoga instructor and can use the abdominal breathing that helps relax us and decrease the adrenergic hormones, and along with the good, you know, things that go along with yoga. Not everyone can do that, though. I don't know. Do you do any online yoga instructing or anything? Because I think we're all going to need some yoga.
You can find me at asthegirlturns.com. I have a couple of videos up on YouTube that, you know, discuss breathing and how to breathe, and as well as a few other things. So, you know, I moved to, one of the reasons that I moved out of California and I am now in this lovely state of Alabama was to try to rebuild that yoga business once again and try to, you know, launch it again under 1099. And of course, now I'm battling this rule.
So you're fighting this, but as you mentioned, those of us who are doing a startup and we're really having great success and trying to build it, and but are now struggling with how do we make ends meet before we're big enough to have an employee, blah, blah, blah. Where does the little guy who doesn't want to spend $500 an hour for an attorney, who themselves may not know how to decipher these nebulous rules, is there sort of a grassroots We the People resource, sort of a 101 guide to the rules that people can tap into? Is IWF, Independent Women's Forum, anyone else doing that out there?
Independent Women's Forum is writing on the topic, trying to break it down, who's affected, who's not. Their policy arm is definitely dissecting the ins and outs of the rule to explain it to the small business person, the entrepreneur. Again, our fellow Karen Anderson, Freelancers Against AB5, got lawyers and other people on her site who help people to not only understand AB5, but how this U.S. Department of Labor rule will also affect them.
Beautiful. Yeah. Well,
help out there.
I don't often make an appeal for folks to consider donating to someone or some group, but Independent Women's Forum does a fabulous job, especially, I think, for women with families that are both professionals and moms. It seems like an awful lot of the fellows there. Isn't it funny? We call you fellows, but you're women. But at any rate, and you don't seem to be bothered by that because you're not woke, you know, whatever. But
not at all.
Isn't it interesting that, but anyway, I would hope that people would support IWF, because whether it's the Center for Economic Opportunity, we're going to be talking with Gabby Hoffman, one of your colleagues, about, you know, about conservation and so forth and the EV rules in the next segment. But folks, if you can't afford a lawyer and you're out there sort of like Don Quixote against the windmills of government, you know, these are the kind of organizations, and IWF is one of them, IWF.org, because there's a lot of heavy lifting that's required, and, you know, they need the engine to drive that bus. So anyway, I would hope that folks would support the organization. And really, thank you for really getting the word out and being the Paul Revere about this issue, because many people are unaware of it, and I think they're flying without radar, Jennifer, and that could be dangerous with a two-tiered justice system. If, you know, I don't think any of us are that important that we can escape the justice. It's only the big guys sitting up in the halls of Congress and in the White House, right? So, I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah. This is part of the problem. And we need as many voices as possible raising the alarm about this, as well as calling your congressional member and your senator regarding this. There is a Congressional Review Act, both in the Senate and in the House, up for review. And you need to call your representative and tell them to sponsor that act, especially with the precarious problems we're having in our Congress right now. That act needs to come up for the vote, and it needs the votes.
That's
so
right. That's the
call
act
your representative
that basically
as well.
That restores the law making and the actual rule reviewing to Congress, so that that fourth branch of government, ever more powerful, the bureaucracy, doesn't really make the law. And that's what they've turned into.
Right.
Jennifer, we thank you. Jennifer, you're just a fabulous, fabulous woman, and I appreciate you so much. Jennifer Oliver O'Connell, thank you for being
so
with us. And we look forward to the next conversation. There she is, and we thank her for being with us. When we come back, we're going to talk to Gabby Hoffman. If you think you're not going to have to buy an EV, think again. If the EPA has their way, they'll make sure that you have one in just a few short years. That coming up on the Randy Tobler Show.
Elizabeth Nader, she says that it was written by someone who's never, ever run a business, who never, ever had to make a payroll. And she's correct. You know, Julie Sue and this wage and labor person whose, you know, testimony was just awful, created a lot of chutes and ladders, a lot of trap for the small business owners. They don't know whether they're coming or going.
Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer, on News Talk STL. Watch us on our live stream using Rumble, Facebook, and Twitter. This is News Talk STL.
Well, welcome back to the program. You know, I love spending time with the women of Independent Women's Forum, and one of our favorites is Gabby Hoffman. Gabriella Hoffman is, of course, the director of the Center for Energy Conservation at the Independent Women's Forum. How you doing, Gabby? It's been a while since we chatted.
It has been a while, Randy. I'm doing well. I'm trying to get my head around all this crazy EV madness. You know, everyone's talking about March Madness for basketball, and I can't be over getting stuck on EV madness, which also coincides with March Madness. So I'm trying to stay stay well.
And I think I'm not, to be very honest, and the audience may kill me for this, but I'm not really a big basketball guy. So while all this is going on, there's a lot of madness going on in Congress, and especially in the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. We just got done talking with Jennifer O'Connell, who, of course, outlined the terrible assault on gig workers. I know you've been big on that,
too. Yeah, she's a fellow with us, I think.
Yeah, right,
with
us
at IWF, yeah.
Right, and her personal story, I mean, it just, these rules in California shut her down, and now the Department of Labor is going to shut down across the country. You know, there's a lot that goes on in the bureaucratic realm that really impact people day to day and day. And now the Biden administration has come down, the EPA has come down with draconian rules, which is an end around EV mandate of sorts. I'd like you to sort of expand what the rules are from the EPA in terms of the auto emissions and what that means for folks in the next few years.
Yes. So they had an original rule that dropped about a year ago, and the ultimate kind of goal that they had was to have 67% of new cars that are in production BEV, to achieve these kind of carbon emissions goals, or carbon emissions reduction goals, rather, that would lead to, I believe they claim it would reduce carbon emissions by 7 billion tons, or pardon, I forget the exact amount, but 7 billion fewer and less carbon emissions. And I think they have the same goal somewhat now. And this new rule is tweaked a little bit. So originally with the first rule, it would really enforce this really stringent rule to pivot car manufacturing across models 2027 to 2023. And the original rule was said to begin enforcement-wise on January 2027. Now they've given car manufacturers a little more time. So it's not really necessarily all car manufacturers are having to start to re-retrofit their models, produce EVs to comply with these standards. And really, the fact that they're telling them you need to make this tells anyone who doesn't have to have a law degree or who doesn't know, you know, how regulations are made. It's very simple. If they're telling them you need to produce this threshold or this percentage of cars, it's a mandate. It's not a standard. When they're telling you to do something, not to improve something, but this has come with both. And so now with this newer unveiled rule, they are setting out to, you know, have certain models begin 2027, this enforcement. Some will be delayed until 2030. But what we've done at IWF in reading in this analysis is the goal is ultimately going to be the same. Close to 70% of models, I've seen somewhere from 50% to nearly 70% of car models will still have to be EV by 2032. Just some of them won't have to begin until 2030. And it's very questionable whether or not those carbon emissions reductions goals they've set out are actually going to be achieved, because there are a lot of questions about EVs actually being environmentally friendly. So yes, it's still a mandate. And while it is being felt by manufacturers, those manufacturers are going to have to pass those costs and that retrofitting onto consumers by offering them fewer choices. This is, you know, common sense. Any regulation or any tax that is imposed on, you know, a producer or a manufacturer is ultimately going to be passed on to the consumers. We're always feeling it. We're seeing it with inflation. We're seeing it with so many other things. So it's going to ultimately pass to the car buyer as well. And the car buyer doesn't want EVs. That's what they're communicating and telegraphing to the government and to the media and to the public. But those entities are not listening.
And, you know, Gabby, you wrote a nice piece in Town Hall about this, and I'd refer people to that. There's also some great blog posts by you and your colleagues at IWF on IWF.org. You know what's really weird? Before this thing dropped from the EPA on, what was it, Wednesday, I guess, last? What was interesting was, it was just the previous week, I was reading a story where Toyota, and old man Toyota is still in charge of Toyota. And, you know, Toyota, I think, for anyone who's in manufacturing, who's in business, who's in quality control, who's in safety science, Toyota set the standard for safety, quality, improvement in processes, reducing prices and improving quality with the line worker that could stop the whole line when something was wrong. Toyota is backing off of EVs and they're going to hybrids, because I think we'd all agree hybrid is a reasonable and growing in demand way to try to move to a different type of both an environmental and an affordable economy. The mileage is great, you know, less emissions. I think it's something we can all agree is a reasonable intermediate step. Toyota, who gets it right more often than they get it wrong in terms of providing what people want and quality improvement, they are saying no to EV at a time when the knuckleheaded government is full throttle ahead. I don't get it, Gabby.
It's actually funny you mentioned Toyota. I have a friend who works on the marketing side there for the outdoor industry, and I was asking him during an interview we did, and I asked him offline, you know, off the record, you know, Toyota, you guys are not going to be going on this gamble for EVs, right? You're not going to be going so crazy. He's like, no, like Toyota actually, he told me, did not really go fully on board an EV mandate because they're a little differently set up than Ford, GM, and some of these other manufacturers. So I don't know if people know this, but I've kind of noticed a trend that manufacturers that have unionized workforces were going along with EVs. Toyota is not unionized. to my understanding. So these kind of non-unionized and, interestingly enough, not really American-based companies, but they do have, obviously, outposts here in the United States. Non-American non-American car companies were not going full throttle on EV mandates. They were offering a few. Toyota had like a few EV prototypes, and they always had said, according to my friend on the inside, that they were, you know, really banking on hybrid models, not so much going full throttle with EV or getting rid of all gas power types. So that's something people have to note, that the ones that have gotten bailed out or that have very unionized shops, they're the ones who largely went along with the Biden administration with this EV mandate. But whether they were, you know, unionized or not unionized, all these manufacturers have seen fewer people wanting to buy EVs. No one is going to car dealers and buying EVs off the lot like hotcakes. We're not seeing that whatsoever. We're actually seeing the opposite effect, a chilling effect, chilling reception to these cars, because people understand that the association of the car is, okay, the government is mandating that car manufacturers make this. Am I losing choices? I'm losing a choice. Government is telling manufacturers to do this. I'm going to have less freedom in terms of consumer choice as a result. So I think the American people are smart, and they see that this is a tool of the government. And this has been tried before. Remember, under the Obama administration, there was already an EV credit that was offered before, but yet that didn't incentivize buyers, American consumers, to go and purchase. And the same is happening here, because it's very questionable as to why that credit is being offered. Are you actually really saving, and are the taxpayers rather subsidizing your purchase? That's very questionable. And also, studies have shown, Randy, as everyone has probably seen before, that the tax credit doesn't ameliorate cost concerns for people in lower and medium income brackets. Those who are buying EVs and even taking advantage of the EV credit are usually people who make $100,000 or more. So it's not going to be felt or accessible or within reach to lower or medium income folks in the United States, because if an EV is about $50,000 on average, what person in low income or even medium is going to afford that?
Well, and, you know, I as a little funny and not so funny aside, remember in the Obama administration when the first EV subsidies came out, I remember John Stossel, our favorite libertarian, you know, he's driving around in a golf cart because it's an electric vehicle, after all, who he got basically got it for free. Got it for free because, of course, whenever the government, and think about it, I don't want to get you into a discussion about education and healthcare, but as I look at the big 30,000 foot view of big government, everything that the government subsidizes ultimately becomes dystopian and dysfunctional. Healthcare, this is the 14th anniversary of Obamacare, which has been a disaster for the majority of people. Education, look at where that's gone. I mean, our academic achievement keeps going down. And now they're subsidizing windmills and solar panels and EVs. And everyone would agree those are inefficient ways and probably not even net carbon neutral ways when you think of the manufacturing cost and distribution cost. Whenever the government puts their foot into something, it just crashes down and it's no good. And that's what I want people to hear you saying, and all of your great work that you do at the Center for Economic for Conservation Energy. You know, you're the Paul Revere of, like, hey, get the government out of this. It'll naturally, organically develop. And I don't know about you, Gabby, but I'd look at if I was in the market for a vehicle, I'd look at a hybrid. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Gets good gas mileage, makes sense. How about you?
If it's not a mandate, I would possibly look into it. But I have a very fuel efficient Subaru Forester that claims to have clean fuel, and it gets 500 mile range. So I love my Forester. That's a very, you know, economically and environmentally friendly car. They're not really virtue signaling on politics that much. They kind of lean a little more crunchy. But I've had my car since 2019. I bought it 2 years old, and it works great. I've had no problems with it, and it's very fuel efficient. I'm not emitting as much as I think I would with other type of cars. But it's still gas powered, and I'm getting a great range, and I don't have to worry about it faltering or collapsing on me. But if people want a hybrid, if they're comfortable charging, by all means, great. But as long as it's a choice and not a mandate, I think that's what people should be offered. But no, if we're talking in terms of, I mean, this is part of Biden's day one directive, or day six directive rather. This was handed down during his January 27th, 2021 climate change directive, where everything, whether it's cars or your energy consumption personally, or if it's energy consumption across the government, anything that has something remotely to do with environment or agriculture. So this administration wants everything to pivot to net zero, which is an impossible goal to achieve because carbon is a necessary part of life, for one. And two, you would have, like you said, you're going to have, everything has an impact. I also wrote this week that even though we saw the federal government, you know, charging forward with their EV mandate, even if slightly tweaked, that's still the same goal. Maine, which now isn't really conservative if we're talking governance, Maine said, we're not going to be adopting California EV standards, which are even more strict, to make 100% of their fleet 100% EV by 2035. And 17 states, including Virginia, and Virginia got into this compact before our current Republican governor, Governor Youngkin. 17 states now are aligned with California standards, and the EPA may look to either replicate or maybe reject California's standards, which are far more harsh than what we currently see, but both are equally punitive. They just have different targets, but they ultimately have the same goal, to pivot to a net zero car economy, which is extremely impossible. I was in California last year, and even though they've been pushing forward with EVs, I still saw gas-powered cars. I don't think people, and they're going to find ways, even if you pivot to EV. We look in California, and we see that they are pivoting to, you know, charge people who use EVs. You're still going to have to pay a tax. I'm not saying that I want gas taxes on EV cars, but I'm saying they're going to find ways to tax EVs because they're not currently subjected to gas taxes. So people who thought EV is going to be an escape route for you to avoid taxation or penalties from the government, they're going to be taxing your car, taxing your energy use, just as they do with people who drive gas-powered cars. So you can't escape it. And you're having to pay for charges, too. It's not free. And it comes from somewhere, from fossil fuel sources. Yeah.
Now, they tell you it's free, but you end up paying for it one way or another. Now, Gabby, before we let you go, I know you're a sportswoman, and folks can follow you on your various podcasts, on your website, GabriellaHoffman.com, on Facebook. 33,000 followers. Belated happy birthday to you, by the way. Belated happy birthday.
Thank you. That's very sweet. Thank you, Randy.
But now, and I'm always envious because I'm going to go out here at the Liberty Lair and going to go fishing here in just a little while today because I think the spring fishing time is waking up. Are you aware that the world record paddlefish was caught at Lake of the Ozarks just this last week here in Missouri?
No.
Yep.
Can you tell me more? Because that's awesome.
Have you ever been paddlefish fishing?
No, I had an acquaintance from social media post that she harvested, didn't take it to keep, but catch and release.
Yeah.
Someone I'm connected to in Texas did that recently too. It's an incredible fish. They have like that saw nose.
Yeah.
Incredible.
They're like prehistoric fish and they're like a prehistoric kind of fish. They have cartilage instead of bones. I hear they're good eating. Yeah. I haven't eaten one. And you snag them. You know, you snag for them. 164-pound, 13-ounce world record at Lake of the Ozarks. Isn't that something?
That is so cool. That is so cool.
All right.
Cool.
Well, you're the next time you're in Missouri, you know you're welcome to come fishing at the lair. My wife and I will host you. We'll go bass fishing here in our pond. Maybe we'll do some paddlefish snagging. But I know you're busy there at Independent Women's Forum. Make sure you continue to have enough time to get out in the great wild outdoors.
Oh, I plan on doing some more. And my travel schedule this year is not so crazy, so I will be getting in some more outdoor time. But I would love to come back to Missouri. I've only been for very short stints to Kansas City. And I forget where else I was also at. But no, I need to come and definitely take you up on that offer. It would be great to link up in person. And no, fishing is great. We're coming into, you know, trout season, stocking.
Yeah.
Soon it's going to be summer. Oh my gosh. And turkey season. I know everyone is very fanatical about turkey hunting. There's so much to do. And I stay sane by doing these activities. I wish I could do them more, but I need to do them more. Right. So it's a good reminder.
We love all the work you do. And they're at IWF. IWF.org. Director for the Center for Energy Conservation at Independent Women's Forum, Gabby Hoffman's been my guest this segment. Thanks, Gabby. Look forward to the next conversation.
Have a great weekend. Thank you, Randy. And happy early Easter.
Same to you. God bless you. All right, there she is. Boy, I'm telling you, they do great work there at IWF. At IWF.org. Now it's your time to do some great work. Give me a call, 314-912-1019. You want to talk about the monstrosity spending bill? You want to talk about the dysfunction in the Republican Party? Should Mike Johnson be replaced with, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Hakeem Jeffries? You let me know. Open lines now from here till the end of the show. We'll wrap it up right after this. 314-912-1019 on 101.9-94.1. News Talk STL. I'll be right back.
Still a man. mandate. And while it is being felt by manufacturers, those manufacturers are going to have to pass those costs and that retrofitting onto consumers by offering them fewer choices. This is common sense. Any regulation or any tax that is imposed on a producer or a manufacturer is ultimately going to be passed on to the consumers. We're always feeling it. Here she come now,
say morning, morning. Randy Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer on News Talk STL.
Good morning, everybody. Tony Colombo and Katie Fitzpatrick here.
Thanks for listening to the Randy Tobler Show here on News Talk STL. And don't forget to join us every weekday at 2 p.m. for Colombo and Katie.
Also, keep it here for my Saturday morning show, the Bluff City Outdoor Show, today at 11. Now, back to Dr. Randy Tobler. Love you, Doc.
Love them, too. And you know what? I had a sense of emptiness on Thursday afternoon. I had a patient come in the office that had an urgent need, like, I don't know, half an hour before I was supposed to be on with Katie and Tony. And it just killed me. I had to say, hey, guys, I got something I have to attend to here. I got a guy that's having some chest pain, whatever. And that's what it was. And they're very gracious because, you know, they planned the show, wanted to have me on there. I'd love to be on. I have a sense of emptiness when I'm not on with them or when I can't listen to them or Chris and Tim or Mike and company, or the other great programming. So I don't know if you did. It's a FOMO. I learned the FOMO a few years ago from the kids. They were like, Dad, we're having FOMO. What do you mean FOMO? I thought it was like a new Sunda topping, but no, you know what FOMO is. We have a caller, Jerome?
Yes, sir. He's been eagerly waiting to share stuff with us.
Caller, welcome to the program. Let's go for it. What's on your mind?
Well, hi. I've called in before. I just wanted to let you know that I appreciate News Talk. I love the new commercials that you're running about a former radio station or a radio station that I used to listen to that Odyssey bought that George Soros owns the majority shareholding in. And I think a gentleman by the name of Robert Hyman would probably turn over in his grave if he knew that Soros owned the radio his radio station. But anyway, he's just saying.
We have professional colleagues and friends that work at that station, and they're pledged to not change their tune. But you know that the tune, there's embellishment and nuance that happens throughout radio broadcasting 24-hour day that it can't help but be affected by management and their philosophy, you know? And so things that on-air people can't control. So, people have a choice.
I just started looking for another radio station to listen to because I saw that radio station start going left. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like it, but regardless,
I can't comment too much. Having been on that radio station in the past before it changed, before Odyssey was bought by Soros, even then it was a big corporate concern. And the more corporater the radio station, the more lefter it goes. How's that for some bad grammar?
Well, that's true. But your regards to Republicans and such. Years ago, I had a friend of mine tell me, Tom, the only difference between a Democrat and a Republican is how you spell it. And I said, oh, no, Charlie, I don't agree with you. But the more I started doing some studying, the more I found out that he was right. And I love Dan Bongino has something that he says that there's no Democrat that's a Republican, and not every Republican or most Republicans are Democrats or something to that effect. I don't know exactly how he says that,
Here's the problem, caller. What's your name?
Okay, Tom.
Tom, here's the problem. We have to look at the situation as it is, not as we would like to think it is. We can't reinvent the truth. The truth is that the government has become so infiltrated at all levels, from elected officials to the bureaucracy, with people that now realize, and this all started when they understood that starting in the early 1900s, when the income tax came about, that they can vote to take your money, and then they can vote to redistribute your money to their voters, right? And they've now cleverly designed it to, Tom, whether you're a senior citizen or whether you're in healthcare or whether you're in education or if you manufacture an electric vehicle or if you're a small business with the SBA, you can get a small business loan. Oh, if you're a veteran, you can get this. If you're a first-time home buyer, you can get that. If you're a student, you can get a loan. So they've cleverly turned all of us into our own little special interest group. Yes, and I don't know how we get out of it, because who's willing to say, yeah, I'll take a haircut so that we can downsize the government? Because no one's willing to take that first step out on that thin ice. That's where we're at.
Over, you're correct. I will tell you this. You know, you talk about health care. I see an upper cervical chiropractor, and he does not take insurance. And the reason that he doesn't take insurance is because if he starts taking insurance, then they can dictate what he can and can't do.
Yeah, yeah. And hey, you know what? I don't take insurance either, but you know what? When most of my patients in my direct-to-patient membership model, it's very interesting. Most of them actually have, quote, insurance. They have an insurance card. But they never really get into that. Rarely do they get into the insurance because the deductibles are so high. And but occasionally they want to use their insurance to get an X-ray, or if I need to get a CT scan or an ultrasound, or they need to see a specialist, and they use their insurance. But when I have to, I am now having to personally talk to pre-authorization, pre-certification people. Like, I want to get an MRI on someone's knee to see if they've got a loose bone fragment in there, or, you know, whatever. I'm telling you, I sit on the line for 45 minutes. Sometimes the line drops. I get transferred to someone in the Philippines or somewhere else. I can't even understand them. Okay. And then get a load of this. They say, what is your NPI number? That's like, you know, it makes me think of Les Mis, you know, prisoner number 526043, whatever that guy's number was, Jean Valjean. And then what is the member's I number? And I sit on the line, and then I tell them, look, I'm not representing the doctor. I am the doctor. I don't have a big staff. That's how I make it affordable for my patients. Can I just speak to another doctor? Well, we'll have to have a peer by peer. Can you fax us all of the medical records? I'm going crazy doing this. And there are people, there are legions of people in medical offices that are trying to do this. Here's my advice for you, Tom, and anyone else listening. If you get denied a service or a pharmaceutical, automatically report the insurance company for denial of care to the insurance department of the state of Missouri. They have to investigate. If your doctor thinks you need it and your insurance company says you don't need it, then you just report them to the Department of Insurance for practicing medicine, denial of care, rationing. Guess what? The Department of Insurance has to investigate that. We need to be the biggest hemorrhoid in the butt of the insurance companies.
I agree.
That's the way to make it happen.
Well, just two more points, and then I'll let you go. One, I've been thinking about trying to get a hold of you because of the fact that you don't take insurance, But the other thing is that I'm over 65. I'll be 72 in June. I'm not on any medications whatsoever, by the way. Zero. Okay. My Medicare Medicaid thing that I got, I have through a company. I don't know. Can I say the company's name, or are we going to get trouble?
Well, you know what? We got to run. Let's talk about it next week. But anyways, if you're with an Advantage plan,
they own a pharmacy. The insurance.
Sure, they do.
A pharmacy.
So, sure they do.
I find that a conflict of interest. So.
Oh, well, there's all kinds of conflicts. The Advantage plans, they'll give you free gauze bandages and rubber gloves and a thermometer, but they'll deny care that you really need. All right, that wraps it up. We're out of time. Thanks all for being here.
Bye-bye.
Let's decompress. Thanks, Tom. Let's talk next week. Hey, guys, we'll be keeping track of all the tyranny. Talk to you next time.